Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Music Business Podcast presented by Hypebot.com. I'm your host, Kyle Boleyn. Today on the show, we are talking with Mary Lee Bliss, who is a trends editor and strategic consultant at YPulse, a youth market research firm. We talked to Bliss about the millennial generation. Who are they and how do they listen to, discover, and interact with music? Make sure that you subscribe to Music Business Podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow the show and get the latest episodes on SoundCloud. And if you like the show, I'd love for you to rate us highly and submit a review in iTunes. Here is our interview with Mary Lee Bliss. So Mary Lee, what is YPulse and what is your role at the company?
So YPulse is a youth market research agency, and we've been studying millennials and teens for about 10 years in a variety of ways. One side of the company is really all about custom research, and we have a panel of 60,000 young people, 13 to 32 years old, who we survey every month. And the other side of the company is really all about our insights and thoughts on this generation and the next generation. So every day we publish an article and a daily newsletter, a free daily newsletter that's all about young consumers, their tastes, how they impact brands, everything from tech to their food behavior and their music behavior and everything in between.
So what kinds of custom research do you do?
Oh, goodness. We work with brands to really help them figure out their core consumer. So if a brand is interested in targeting millennials and teens, we can help them to do that in a variety of ways with our custom research. So we do everything from segmentations to kind of break down their audience and see through data who the most optimal person for them to be talking to is. But we also do really cool kind of more qualitative projects like pop-up communities that allow brands to talk to young consumers and actually co-create products with them or co-create marketing campaigns so that young consumers are actually more of a part of the process. And help brands to, as we so lovely say it, suck less, basically.
What are some of the companies that you typically work with?
Well, some of this work that we do is proprietary, but we have done a ton of work with large entertainment brands. If you look at our site, you can see some of our work with MTV. We've also done work with large nonprofits like Teach for America and the Truth Organization, tech brands like Intel. Really, because our focus is the consumer, our clients run the gamut, and we can really talk to any brand that's interested in understanding millennials and teens more and really interested in focusing in on that segment of consumer.
So we're going to throw around the term millennial a lot on today's show. For anyone who isn't familiar, can you kind of define that term and describe some of the traits of that generation?
Absolutely. It's a really interesting question, especially right now, because millennial as a term has become almost overused in the past few years as interest in the generation has ramped up so much. We define millennials as being born between 1982 to 2004. That's the traditional kind of definition of a generation, about 20-year span. And it's also the definition that Neil Howe uses, and he is one of the people who coined the term millennials. However, there are lots of people who define millennials as 18 and older and see teenagers as a new generation. And really, because we survey 13 to 32-year-olds every month and have a panel that kind of runs the gamut of both of those groups, we're happy to work with whatever definition our clients use or whoever we're talking to uses. But generally, we can say it's young consumers today, whether you say that's teenagers and everybody up into their 30s, or you just want to define it as 18 to 32, we still see that there are commonalities between those groups, and they do have some shared core characteristics. Some of those are more amplified on the older end of the spectrum and a little bit lessened on the younger end, but we absolutely see that millennials in general are an optimistic generation. They also really see the world and love to kind of communicate with each other in groups. So anything that they're doing, whether it be working in an office to, you know, communicating on mobile, everything is done with this kind of group mentality. And that group mentality is, of course, amplified by the technology that they've grown up with. And I think another thing about millennials and teens today is that they're really interested in individuality. So they're looking for uniqueness and authenticity. And those two words are buzzwords that, again, have almost become overused, but it's because there's so much truth to it. And when they're looking at brands or people, whatever it may be, products, they're looking for things that stand out and help them to stand out within the crowd.
So how does this notion of being a digital native or born digital or young and the digital fit into this characterization of a millennial?
It's interesting because millennials, older millennials especially, are very aware that they're the first generation to grow up with social media as a norm and to grow up hand in hand with the internet. So there's almost a badge of pride there. When we ask millennials to describe their generation, technology use really rises to the top of their descriptions. So they're very aware of their own tech savviness. So it's another characteristic of the generation, but it also amplifies, as I said, some of their core values. So, you know, being in a group and communicating as a group is incredibly important to them. And all of those kind of tendencies, which were baked into them at young ages by their parents and schools who put them in a circle instead of sitting in rows and told them to work as a team, then that kind of thought process becomes amplified when you're able to be in a group text chain with your friends all day long or keep tabs of your core peer group via social media whenever you might want to, which is all the time. So some of their characteristics have been amplified by tech, and then tech itself has, you know, really become a core characteristic of the generation.
So if I'm an indie artist who is interested in reaching the millennial generation with my music, what kind of marketing advice would you give me?
Well, what we've really seen, especially in, you know, the last 10 years, is that creating your own brand is very much a possibility and also very much something that young artists today need to do. And when we see labels looking at new talent, one of the things they actually look at is how many followers do they have. So, you know, millennials are incredibly savvy about creating a personal brand online, and it's almost second nature to them. So really, an indie artist today probably is already doing many of these things, but creating a following and creating that brand online on whatever platform makes sense for you, whether that be YouTube or Tumblr or Instagram, wherever it makes most sense for you to be as a person and wherever you're most comfortable, because it has to feel authentic and you have to be communicating with the people who you feel are, you know, your music is going to resonate with. Wherever that might be, creating that following and creating that personality online is super essential.
So in your view, what would be a few of the best ways to connect with that millennial audience? Like, are there any specific platforms that work better than others?
I wouldn't necessarily say certain platforms work better than others, although we've certainly seen YouTube, of course, become kind of a birthplace for a lot of new stars. But I think no matter what platform you're on, whether it's Twitter or YouTube, conversing with fans and being open and having that dialogue is the part of the interaction that they're looking for. They want to follow artists and devote their time and energy to artists who feel like friends to them, who feel accessible to them. And one of the things that we've seen a lot of young indie or not indie artists do very well, and one way that they've become successful is to have very open, honest dialogues online with their fans. So I think that activity and that kind of constant conversation that social media and YouTube and platforms that open artists up to their fan bases allow all of this kind of new socialization between the artist and the fan, that's the part that I think is essential, rather than necessarily choosing one platform over another because it's you know, proven more successful for more artists. I think it's more about optimizing whichever platform you are using and making sure that you're engaging with your followers as much as you can.
So an open and honest dialogue is what really resonates with this particular generation.
Absolutely. You know, when we're talking about outside of the music sphere, just talking about the celebrities, and I almost say that in quotes because they're not celebrities in the traditional sense that millennials and teens are interested in, YouTubers and digital influencers have really risen above, you know, the traditional Hollywood celebrity. They are more interested in following them. They're more interested in hearing what they have to say. And it's because of that authenticity and that rawness and that realness. You know, these are people who feel like they have flaws and they're willing to showcase them. And it's part of their charm and their personality. So really that polished, perfect kind of celebrity that I think a lot of older millennials grew up used to, you know, that kind of perfectly packaged person who the studio put a nice shine on. That's not necessarily as appealing as someone who feels like a peer.
So I'm sure a lot of indie artists ask themselves whether or not they could whether or not they should consider partnering with a specific brand who also happens to target millennials. What are your thoughts on those partnerships between bands and brands?
I think that for this generation, the concept of selling out is a passé concept. So I think, you know, in the past, there was a real resistance among Xers and boomers to be aligned with brands if they're a musician. But for millennials, I think there's a real understanding that that's kind of what you have to do to make a living. And it's not necessarily looked down on. So, you know, you have people like Sour Patch Kids with the Sour Patch House in Williamsburg, where they house, you know, up and coming bands, and all they ask is that they tweet or, you know, Instagram or whatever it might be, that they're staying there. And it, you know, it's a way for a band that might not necessarily be able to afford staying in a cool place near all the action to kind of get a leg up. That's kind of one brand collaboration that we've seen that's ongoing that, you know, previous generation might have said, oh God, they're staying at the Sour Patch House, that's so lame. But I think this generation really feels like, you know, they're not as resistant to brand interactions, and they understand that, you know, having your song used in a commercial or having a brand give you something to help your career out is kind of the way that things work now, and they're not averse to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a really huge generational shift. Like, I grew up in the 90s, and, you know, when Yo La Tengo put a song in a McDonald's ad, they basically had to hide it from everyone. And now, you know, 20 years later, it's kind of the norm. It's almost strange if a band doesn't have their music in a commercial.
Totally.
You know, so let's kind of switch over and talk about YouTube, because I feel like that's generally, you know, the way a lot of people listen to and discover new music, and especially young people. So mm-hmm. Do you think YouTube has so much appeal just because it's free as opposed to the service you have to pay for? Or is there something else more specific to YouTube that you think young people are really attracted to?
I think it being free is certainly one of the biggest parts of its appeal. When we ask young consumers, 13 to 32, what sources they get their music from, YouTube is at the top. And that's including, you know, platforms like Pandora and Spotify. They get their music from YouTube more than those places. And I think part of it is, yes, the fact that it's free, but I think another part of it is the discovery element. You know, with something like Pandora, you're being fed an artist based on this algorithm. But with YouTube, there's much more of this individual discovery element. And I think that millennials and, you know, any young consumer, yeah, I think this would be of any generation, love the feeling of being the first to discover something new and cool so that they can share it then with their friends. And I think YouTube allows that discovery in a little bit more of an organic way. And then the other part of it is exactly what I was saying before, that feeling of community. You know, we have had a debate within our organization whether we should qualify YouTube as a entertainment platform or a social media. And the reality is the line is completely blurred. It is both. You know, it is both a broadcasting mechanism and a social mechanism because there's so much conversation that happens with YouTube influencers and musicians that's all about interacting with their fans and their followers. And that is a huge appeal that a platform that's just feeding you music doesn't necessarily have.
Yeah, and YouTube is actually going to roll out a paid tier at some point. They've been in beta for quite a while, but I think there's a plan to actually open YouTube Music Key to the public, and that's going to be the paid service. So that's going to be competing with Spotify and Apple Music and, you know, any number of other services. Mm-hmm. Do you think millennials are going to be interested in paying for that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Throughout their history, since they were young, they have found ways around paying for anything. You know, older millennials are the Napster generation. Like, they figured out how to get and share music without paying for it, and that completely disrupted the entire industry. At the same time, they do want to support the artists that they like. So I think if it's communicated to them in a way that this is a, you know, going to help the artists that they are fans of, then possibly yes. And certainly Spotify has had success and, you know, much of that is a paid platform. So I think it depends on how it's communicated to them and how much they get out of it.
So Pandora is also really popular with millennials and it's popular with a lot of people. But, you know, one of the things about Pandora that's
Courtney, I just lost you there for a little bit.
Oh, no. So basically, Pandora is also very popular with millennials. And I was just wondering about sort of the personalization aspect of it, Pandora. And again, you know, pre-millennials, you had to listen to the radio and the radio served you whatever they wanted to serve you. Right. And now with Pandora, I mean, again, you're getting served content, but you can control somewhat the content that you're being served. So do millennials really want the personalization?
Yeah, I think absolutely they do. Customization and personalization are huge draws for them, whether that be in a product or whether that be in a medium. They are looking for ways to make something feel like theirs. You know, this is a generation that has grown up curating playlists, whether that be in a mixtape form for older millennials or on their iPod for younger millennials. They're used to having that control over the music and over the creative output of the artist that they like. So what they also are very used to mashing up songs and manipulating videos that their artists are putting out. So customization is a huge part of music for them, a huge part of life. And I think a big way that brands can appeal to millennials is to add elements of personalization to their marketing. It's something that we actually wrote a post not too long ago called Three Lessons Brands Could Learn from Taylor Swift. Seriously, because she's a huge, huge talent when it comes to marketing herself to her fans. And one of the things that she is amazing at is personalizing her relationship with fans. So that's obviously another kind of spin on personalization, but I think it kind of speaks to how important personalization and customization is to them. At the same time, I think there's something interesting happening where, you know, millennials have become so used to algorithms feeding them content, and they really do like it. So they love those suggestions. And when we ask them, you know, have you ever acted on a suggestion that a site like Netflix or Amazon or Pandora has given you, it's in the 90s, those who say that they have. So they like those suggestions and they'll continue to use them, and they certainly want brands and platforms to continue to give those to them. But at the same time, there's kind of this desire now for a little bit of surprise and delight. So we kind of see this counter trend happening where they do want to be surprised a little bit more. So I think that's another thing that they're starting to look for. And it doesn't mean that anybody should veer away from giving them those customized playlists and giving them those suggestions. But I think that in addition to the customization, they're also looking for those elements of surprise now.
Yeah. And I mean, what are some examples of brands doing really well personalizing their messaging and experience for millennials? And it gets very easy to tell which brands are good at this and which aren't. There's the brand Saying Bay Twitter, which is, of course, a great mockery of the band.
Yes.
Kind of try to get some millennials, but they don't quite do it because they're like, oh, kids this week like this slang word. Let's put that in a message.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are, because it's hard. I mean, it's hard to sort of capture that correctly. So what are some of the things that you see brands maybe doing well in terms of like personalizing experiences for millennials?
Yeah. So, you know, it's super simple, but Coca-Cola's campaign last year, personalizing the cans and bottles, actually reversed a decline in sales for them in a huge way. And it was embraced by young consumers. And it seems so simple and almost to other generations might seem gimmicky, like, oh, their name is on a bottle, really? But they embraced it in this incredibly creative way. And all of these videos and virals and memes kind of spun out of the fact that this long-standing traditional product was for the first time ever being given a little bit of a personalized spin. And I think the fact that the brand really allowed those things to happen and embraced them, so, you know, posted viral content that their consumers were creating, like birth announcements and marriage proposals using the customized and personalized Coke cans, they would post those to their blogs and celebrate them. So I think, you know, that was a really great combination of giving a personalized product to young consumers and then really embracing and celebrating the way that they use it. And I think that's part of it because
yeah,
millennials are creative and they do really prize creativity. So shining a spotlight on that when they do get creative is always, always encouraged.
Yeah. So let's talk about the research that you've done with the favorite artists of young people. So you had this amazing blog post you put up a couple weeks ago about this, and there was a lot of really fascinating, I think kind of counterintuitive stuff in there. So, you know, the first thing that I saw was the Beatles are popular with teens and 20-somethings because mm-hmm. the Beatles are popular with everyone at this
yeah.
point. So that, it makes sense. I mean, they're the Beatles. But, you know, the Beatles aren't available on any streaming services. So, mm-hmm. you know, when you look at the Beatles or Queen or Led Zeppelin, who also were popular, are kids getting these from, like, their parents or from YouTube or from iTunes? Like, how are kids coming to discover these bands?
Yeah, I would say their parents are probably their first point of entry. Millennials are incredibly influenced by their boomer parents. And then this is a generation that was raised by many parents who wanted to be their friends, in addition to being their parents. But, you know, there's this whole parenting movement where boomers wanted to have such a close relationship with their kids because they didn't have that with their parents, their own parents. So the two generations really influence each other hugely because millennials have a kind of more friend-based relationship with their boomer parents than, say, Xers did. And so they're learning and listening to and embracing the culture and the, you know, music and television and movies that their boomer parents grew up with. And at the same time, they influence their boomer parents, whether that be introducing them to Apple products or introducing them to, you know, Beyonce. Whatever it might be, we really see them kind of influencing one another equally. So I think with groups like the Beatles and Led Zeppelin, all of these things that we see on their top 25 artist list, absolutely, I think boomers are a number one point of entry for them.
Interesting. I'm slightly older than millennial. I'm the very sort of end of Gen X, and my parents are at the very beginning of the boomers, but like they turned me on to a lot of classic rock, and that mm-hmm. was like the soundtrack of my youth. And I'm just wondering if your parents did the same thing.
Yeah, my parents absolutely did the same thing. In fact, I'm kind of an enigma in that for my up until I was in middle school, the only thing I listened to was the oldies station. I didn't actually listen to any pop stations or know any pop songs. So I really grew up listening to my parents' music. And I think a lot of millennials had that experience. You know, maybe not to the extreme I did, where I didn't know that pop music existed outside of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But absolutely, you know, were kind of indoctrinated by their parents' music at a young age. And my husband had a very similar experience. We're both older and millennials. His mother was a DJ and absolutely, you know, schooled her kids in the music of her day and her favorites. So I think we've really grown up with a mix. And I think the other thing about millennials to remember, and this is with all entertainment, is that they're a generation that grew up in the rerun and VHS and oldies station years. So they grew up when all of the culture and the entertainment that their parents had was repackaged and resold to them. So they had many opportunities that previous generations might not have had to have access to all of this. In new ways. So I think they're much more open to embracing the kind of pop culture moments and the pop culture characters and individuals of their parents' generation in a real authentic way, because that was part of their childhood too.
Yeah, so back in 2006, which I just realized was like 9 years ago, because I feel like I just read this article yesterday and it's still so relevant, New York Magazine did a cover story called Up with Grups, which kind of looked at the fact that a lot of the traditional generational divides of fashion and music and pop culture were pretty much being erased. And whereas the boomers' parents would have like really disapproved of some of the music they were listening to, boomer parents and their kids, you know, have a much more fluid back and forth. And I don't think you get a lot of millennials turning mom and dad onto like, you know, Skrillex, but, you know, like I turned my dad on to Elliot Smith and I've turned him on to Sufjan Stevens. And, you know, there's a little bit more back and forth there. Mm-hmm. But it sort of begs the question then, you know, where is the cultural rebellion going to come from? I mean, if kids and their parents, like if dad's listening to Joy Division and the kids are listening to Interpol, you know, they're pretty much the same band. So, you know, so do you see like... Do you see any kids starting to say, well, okay, you know, I'm going to listen to something really different from what my parents are listening to just to try to break away from that?
You know, millennials are notoriously unrebellious. And part of it is growing up in that environment of being friends with their parents. Like, what do you really have to rebel against if you have a kind of sweet situation like that? But a part of it is also being a very risk-averse and cautious generation. So they're not really going to be the ones to rebel. The next generation, whether you define that as teens or below, might have more of an opportunity to rebel. We haven't really seen it happen yet. But I think, you know, you mentioned Skrillex. Like, that movement and the EDM movement is certainly something that I think fewer boomers understand than they might understand Sufjan Stevens, you know? So I think there are elements at play where young consumers are kind of creating their own culture, and it really looks so different from anything that boomers might have seen before. So it might not be rebellion in the Gen X sense of, you know, we are outright saying that we hate you. But I think it's rebellion in millennial sense. It's a little bit safer. It's largely optimistic. It's hugely about a group and a culture and a community. But it is very different from maybe what their parents might recognize and even what their parents might approve of. Like, I don't think a lot of parents would approve of a lot of what goes on at a rave.
Yeah, that's probably true. Getting back to sort of the stuff that parents and kids do agree on for a minute. So, you know, music exclusives have become this huge strategy for streaming services to try to attract audiences, and whether they're working or not is kind of up for debate. But, you know, just to think about if Apple got the Beatles on Apple Music, which so far the Beatles are not on any streaming platforms, unless you count YouTube. Do you think a move like that would bring teenagers and 20-somethings onto a service like Apple Music? Mm.
The problem is that they are so adept at getting the content that they want, whether or not you give it to them. So it's hard for me to say that that would have any group kind of streaming to the platform that has that exclusive deal, because I think they're so used to finding ways around the limitations that labels and brands have tried to put on music. And they really have this mentality that, you know, it's out there and I can get it and I, you know, I have rights to it. And even though legally that we know that is not the truth, creatively, they really feel like they have a right to have access to that music. And they've grown up kind of with this system or many systems in place to get it, whether that be, you know, a shared cloud folder where all their friends are dumping content and they're able to grab whatever tracks they want, to, you know, the old school, you know, older millennial when we would download off LimeWire or whatever we could find that day that worked. So it's hard for me to say that some deal like that would make them all, you know, flow over to a paid service. That being said, stranger things have happened and I would never say never. But they are really, really adept and have shown over and over again that they'll find a way to get it their way.
See, everything that you just said there was plainly spoken, well-informed, in absolute reality, and you almost feel like the music industry executives sometimes have their head ups in the cloud when they're thinking like, all right, the way we're going to do this is we're going to get all the music on our service instead of the other service, and then people are going to pay us the money. You're like, what? No, people already know how to get that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to change when you've been in a really great position for the better part of, you know, a century. And that's what we've really seen with the music industry. And they don't want to let go of the controls. And why would they want to? But they are certainly facing a completely new reality. You know, we're not at the start of a disruption. We are well into, you know, decades into a disruption of an industry, and millennials have been at the core of that disruption. So trying to, you know, work against all the ways that millennials get their music and the way that they access their content, it's not going to work for very long.
So I'd be curious, obviously Spotify has taken off in recent years, and I think they're up to 20 million subscribers. Have you done any research into millennials' attitudes towards paying the $9.99 a month for a music streaming service? Is that something that they're receptive to? And like, of that audience, which of them are most receptive?
You know, we haven't done any research, but I actually would love to. And, you know, we do survey them monthly. So I have lots of opportunities to ask questions that come up like this. So I'd love to take a look at how many of them are actually paying. We do know, as of a research survey, that 21% of 13 to 32-year-olds say that they use Spotify. And I'd be willing to bet that those that are going to pay for it are probably going to be in the, you know, 20 to 29 range, because I think that that's the heaviest use. I think it's 49% of 21 to 24-year-olds are using Spotify compared to 41% overall. That being said, those with a disposable income are going to be older than that. So, you know, in their 29 to 32-year-olds. So, you know, somewhere in the older stretch of millennials is where I would see the payers of a service like Spotify being. But I would love to survey around that and, you know, follow up with you guys and see what we find out.
That would be excellent. Another thing that I'm thinking about as we talk is that Spotify recently put video and podcasts into their service, along with a wider array of personalized playlists. The video part is interesting to me, and I'm really kind of curious what you think about it, because depending on how you look at it, you could say, oh, well, you know, most people actually don't have that many apps on their phone. It's highly likely that they don't have a video app besides YouTube. So putting a bunch of snackable content inside Spotify is pretty smart. Younger people might be more prone to do it. But on the other hand, it was really unclear to me because a lot of that programming wasn't that music focused. It wouldn't even have music as a background element to it as a driving force. So it was just really unclear to me how this would resonate with the younger audience, if it was like a smart move or like a business move.
Yeah, absolutely it was. Right now we're in a position where we're seeing a lot of platforms that were focused on doing one thing to draw in young consumers try to amplify their use. So you see it with Snapchat where, you know, initially that was all about just exchanging photos, but now Snapchat is shaping themselves into a media destination. And it's all because they want more of millennial and teens' times. They want more time with their eyes because more time with their eyes and their ears means more likely that an advertiser will pay to be a part of that platform. So I think absolutely video is a huge draw for millennials and teens. And you see that obviously from YouTube on. Vine, another great example. So Spotify adding video is, I would say, 100% an effort to appeal to young consumers. I do think that, you know, if you are a music platform, having that video content that you're providing, at least in the beginning, be related to music and that culture would be wise. However, you know, I'm not going to say it's not going to work because video and mobile video is in this incredible growth phase, and it is just really booming, and it's all because of the amount of content that young consumers consume and the amount of snackable content that they're looking for. So absolutely would never say that it wouldn't work, and absolutely will say that's probably to try to draw in more young users.
You know, it's crazy when you think about it, right? Like, everyone is essentially competing with everyone. And what they're competing for is your attention. Like anyone, I'll just sit there in my bed, like I'll wake up, turn off the alarm, then I'm like, let's just stare at my phone for a little bit. And I'm just like, you're just stealing entire moments of my day. Someone is monetizing this attention in some way. And we're so easily kind of duped into just getting like lost in our phones and whatever that content is. It's really challenging to try to like draw those boundaries and kind of realize when your own attention is kind of being hijacked towards all these different apps that you have all these habits with. And even though it's good time spent with the app where you're potentially learning something, you're also not doing a lot of other things in your day.
Sure. And we do see young consumers struggle with that. And we do ask them about unplugging and what, you know, kind of role unplugging from tech plays in their life. And a significant number of millennials and teens do say that they make an effort to unplug every once in a while. Whether that's, you know, putting your phone at the center of the table when you're having dinner with your friends, or actually saying, you know, I'm going to have a completely tech-free weekend. You know, there are tech-free camps for quote-unquote grown-ups, millennials who don't probably consider themselves grown-ups yet, but there are tech-free camps for grown-ups where you can go and you turn your cell phone in, and, you know, that is your time. You're now devoting your time to in-person interactions and, you know, being in the moment. So we do see kind of a movement of that, and it's something that I think millennials and teens absolutely are aware of and struggle with, but at the same time, you know, that distraction engine, that distraction industry is pretty powerful, and there's no way that they're going to resist it completely.
How do you monitor the things that are trying to steal your attention?
I don't. I am constantly online for my job and that ends for my social life, and I don't try to monitor it at all, which is probably not very good for me or my eyes or my ears. But I throw myself into it fully. I'm immersed.
You are one with the brands.
I am one with the brands and the networks and everything that lets me communicate more with, you know, my friends and family. I'll spend the time, and as you know, anything that will give me shareable content, I'll spend time with that. So I resist it very little, sadly.
Which I think is like the trade-off, right? Like, we give up certain amounts of our time and our distraction for this added benefit of connecting everyone to everyone we love and being plugged into this whole other world that exists in our phone that can sometimes be much more stimulating than the kind of dull world around us at times.
Sure, absolutely. And I think, you know, that one thing people often misunderstands about millennials and teens, when they see them on their phones all the time, they see that as a very isolating action. But for millennials and teens, it's not about the isolation, it's about the connection. Now, does that connection mobily take away sometimes from the in-person connections that they could be having? Yes, it can also amplify them. There's, you know, it's a more complex issue than saying, oh, look at that teen on their phone. They're so cut off from the world around them. There's a lot more going on there and a lot more at play. And, you know, kind of one of the things we try to do at Y Pulse is dig underneath those reputations and those stereotypes and those assumptions and kind of get at the why behind the what of, you know, there's a behavior, you might think something about it. Some of that might be true, but there are other elements at play that's important to understand if you're going to understand these consumers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really great point. Like, you know, and that's a huge generational divide because, like, I'm on my phone all the time. It's very rarely out of my hand, and I'm pretty much okay with it. You know, and I know that I can put it down and walk away if I absolutely have to, but older people see that and they're sort of horrified by it. And I've been traveling and had my laptop or my iPad with me at a hotel, and people are just like, oh, are you working? And I'm like, no, I'm reading or talking to my friends or just randomly scrolling through Instagram feeds of puppies, and that's my relaxation. And there's, you know, it's this weird, every time I see like old men yelling at clouds about people staring at their phones, I'm just kind of like, yeah, you don't get it. This is not, like, this is the new normal for people. And this is just as valid a way of socializing as talking to someone. They're two different ways of doing something, but neither is right or wrong. And as long as you're not, you know, in a moving car or driving a moving vehicle with your cell phone in your hand, as long as you're not hurting right. anyone, who cares how you choose to communicate?
Yeah, and I think that's a very millennial attitude, even though you say you're not a millennial. And I think there is a divide between, you know, young consumers who feel this is completely natural and there's nothing wrong with it, and some older consumers who feel that it's wrong and it's unnatural. You know, my sister once told me that a stranger, chastised her in the coffee line for looking at her phone. You know, she was waiting for an important work email that she had to respond to right away. So she was, you know, doing her job, but he chastised her for, you know, being sucked into her device. And that was a stranger. So I think that there is that tension there. Wow. At the same time,
I would have probably punched that guy in the face.
You know, I think she wanted to. And I'm sure, visually, she gave him a look that was the equivalent of a punch in the face. And that's a tension we definitely see.
Yeah, I'll say this about myself and then I'll ask you more actual interesting questions. But so I'm right on the borderline of Gen X and millennial. I was born in 80. So, you know, mm-hmm. there are people who think millennial is 80 and up. But the way I talk about it is I went to see the David Foster Wallace movie last night and I cried through the entire thing and then I tweeted about it. So that's my little capsule generation is basically like, yep, right on the border. But let's get back to the music stuff for a minute, because I think there's still some cool stuff to talk about there. So, you know, when you did your survey, a lot of the people said that they didn't have a favorite artist. So do you think that's because they, you know, there's too many artists that they like, or that they kind of just don't care and they're like, oh, I listen to whatever's on? Like, what's up with the idea of people not having a favorite?
Well, you know, I think you can look at that and, again, you know, maybe if you're from an older generation, you might say, oh God, they don't care about music. But really, we see very much the opposite. You know, they're incredibly, young people have always been, but we really see millennials and teens be incredibly passionate about music. You know, in that post, we included the stats that we had from a recent survey. 80% say that music is an important part of their lives. And 70% agree I couldn't get through a week without music. You know, this is, they're passionate about it and it's vital to them. So not having a favorite artist, I think part of it is having too many to choose from. And I think part of it is because they're interested in so many music genres, and they're not necessarily all about one taste anymore. You know, again, I kind of referenced them being the playlist generation earlier. And if you're creating all of these playlists and it's kind of a melange of artists from all over the place, music genre doesn't necessarily define you anymore. I don't think that you can segment millennials into, you know, this group likes pop. Like, there might be some that like pop more than others, but those people who like pop might also like EDM and country, and rap. And the people who like rap a little bit more than others might also like country and hardcore metal. Like, there's fewer lines and fewer kind of buckets that they put themselves in. So I think they're really open to embracing multiple genres, and not having a favorite artist is kind of part of that. You know, they're really open to multiple artists, and it probably changes by the day because they're listening to so many different kinds.
Yeah, I almost feel like this generation is now, they've moved away from genre and they're much more into context. So, you know, what I tend to see a lot is playlists that are totally mixed genre, but it's like, this is the playlist for running, this is the playlist for cooking dinner, this is the playlist for drinking on a Saturday night. And, you know, people tend to respond to that mix much more than like, I'm going to put on some rock music.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this was a qualitative survey, so these were open-end responses. So after they told us their favorite artist, they could, you know, explain that to us. And, you know, some people said, you know, I just don't follow one genre, or I have too many. And some of them said, you know, it really just depends on my mood. So mood, I think, is a bigger influencer of what they're listening to than the genre it's packaged in.
I do want to talk about one genre, and that's EDM, because, you know, I feel like this has died out a little bit, but for a while there, it looked like EDM was like the genre for the millennial generation. But there were no EDM artists on any of the lists. And, you know, I'm wondering if that's just because EDM is kind of not as cool as it was, or whether EDM, because it's so much more focused about the experience and less about the individual DJ, you know, people might really like EDM, but they don't have a favorite DJ because they just go to the events and dance and have a good time.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that at play for sure, that, you know, EDM is a culture and a music genre. So there might not be necessarily a top of mind favorite EDM character, or, you know, music star, whoever it might be, that comes to their head when we say, who's your favorite artist? But also keep in mind, you know, we asked 1,000 millennials, which is a drop in the bucket, and we culled that down to their top 25. So there might be, you know, multiple people who are mentioning various different EDM artists in the huge, you know, response pool. But when you call it down to, you know, those artists that are mentioned the most, they're not necessarily rising to the top. And that makes sense, because EDM isn't necessarily about, you know, that mainstream listener. And I still think it's growing. I don't think it's not as cool as it used to be, but it certainly doesn't have, you know, the kind of following that, you know, a Taylor Swift who rose to the top might have. It's still a growing genre.
So the other thing that was interesting to me was all the artist names were established, and I'd heard of almost all of them. I think there were one or two bands that I had to look up. But I feel like, you know, these are all people with like careers and multiple hits. I mean, does this mean that kids are kind of waiting to get attached to someone until after they see this person isn't like a one-hit wonder or just going to go away?
I'm not necessarily sure that that is what it is. I think when you're doing a qualitative survey, and we often will kind of mention this when we're going through qualitative responses, part of what they are writing down is what's top of mind for them. So part of it is the real answer, like, this is my favorite. And part of it is, oh, I was just thinking about this, or, oh, you know, that's a quick answer that comes to my head. So if it's a newer artist that they are just getting to know, that they might just be starting to grow that devotion to, there might be a less of a likelihood that they'll say it just because it's not as top of mind for them because they haven't thought about them as much. They haven't seen them as much. So I think there's certainly that element to it that kind of influences their responses.
Cool. Well, I think that's a pretty great way to kind of wrap it up. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me.
And if people want to find you online, where can they do that?
Yeah, anybody who is interested can go to ypulse.com. You can sign up for our daily newsletter there. You can, you know, read our Millennial Newsfeed, which is a daily curation of all things young consumer related. And we always update our content on the site, so that's the place to go.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of the Music Business Podcast. Thank you to Hypebot for helping us put this show out. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please send me an email at kyle.bylin@gmail.com. That's kyle.bylin@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion.